Horrific Network Entertainment.
Welcome to the flagship show of the Horrific Network, featuring interviews with icons of the entertainment industry. This is the Horrific Podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to a new Horrific Podcast, man. We are back, and it has been a little bit of a hiatus as I've been pretty damn busy traveling around and seeing a lot of cool stuff. First went on a cruise with my wife for our 7th wedding anniversary, which was a lot of fun. Came back from that, immediately turned around and got ready to go to WrestleMania 40 with my parents, which was also an amazing trip. Like, I have not seen, and I know there's going to be some people who think this, but the level of emotion that was invested in WrestleMania 40, I think is stronger, or was stronger, than most WrestleMania events in the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years, with the Cody Rhodes versus the Bloodline story happening, man. I think that we got a whole lot of fun stuff going on, and I think that what we really had was the culmination of a great story. Great story, great overall just amazing time. And I do think that we will see Cody Rhodes go out of his way to be one of the, if not the best champions possible. Especially, I mean, Roman Reigns' title reign is a tough act to follow. And all of this is stuff that I will be getting on into when we finally do get to a point of being able to start our wrestling show, which I am calling No Words Barred. And I hope that everybody enjoys No Words Barred as much as, you know, I hope and I think you will. I think that it's definitely going to be one of those ones that I think I'm going to try to take three to five good things, 3 to 5 bad things, and, you know, maybe 1 or 2 okay things from the world of wrestling and for that particular, you know, week, and talk about them a little bit. What was stupid? What was not so stupid? What was working good? What wasn't working good? Yeah, that wasn't the only thing. You know, my traveling wasn't the only thing to, you know, really come out of this hiatus. We also got the dates and single night tickets and kind of a good fun talking look at HHN 33. And the new slogan is now Horror Lives Here, I've been told. That's what we're doing. That's what we're working with. Horror Lives Here. And what that entails, what that is the 2024 slogan, apparently. At least it's not something with Scream Squad, and at least it's not Scream Squad related. At least it's not, you know, See You in the Fog. You know, I feel like all of that has been done to death. And I think that the design, you can get it in orange or black right now if you want to buy a shirt. Looks fun. A lot of people I know are not crazy about it. I loved the Oddfellow Tarot design of last year. This design, I'm actually really liking the orange a lot. I think that the orange is probably my favorite part of it, just because it pops. It pops quite a bit, actually. And I think that if that is any indication to come, that this should be pretty pretty dope graphic and design year for HHN. And I think that we will finally, you know, possibly, if rumors are all true, see the return of Freddy Krueger to Halloween Horror Nights, which is interesting. I think that, you know, seeing Freddy, I think that that would be pretty dope, man. I think that Freddy Krueger is one of those people, one of those things that will forever be loved by the horror community. Like, it really does not matter where we are, what we're doing, how we're doing it. I think that Freddy Krueger persona will forever be iconic, and people will always go back to the original franchise with a lot of love and admiration for it. And because of that, it's something that HHN can revisit again and again and again. One thing that we talked about, who, and this character even made kind of a HCW appearance for a little while, is the Ice Cream Man on Campfire Chronicles last year. Campfire Chronicles, we're going to be recording another episode, by the way. But the Ice Cream Man of Campfire Chronicles, man. And that is portrayed by Clint Howard. It is a cult classic movie. And it is just one of the many iconic roles that Clint Howard has put forward in his filmography, man. You could find Clint Howard from everything into, you know, Star Wars to dramas to the Andy Griffin Show. Like, he's done literally everything. And of course his brother Ron and his niece Bryce Dallas. I mean, the family, the Howard family, is pretty iconic. And today we have Clint Howard, an interview I did with him a while back as the meat and potatoes of our podcast. Everything's kind of out of sorts this week. You know, we kicked it off, you know, Tuesday, yesterday, with another Haunt Graveyard. Haunt Graveyard is back. Hope you are enjoying some of the haunts of 2021 after the COVID year is where we are. We're finishing 2021, and we will move our way into 2022 throughout the spring and summer here. Essentially, if you don't know by now, but I technical direct for the Seattle Mariners minor league affiliate in our hometown. And so that takes me out a week, sometimes 2 weeks at a time, depending on the team's schedule. And so if we can't record a Campfire Chronicles a certain week, instead of the wrestling HCW that we were kind of supplementing with last year, we're just going to supplement with Hunt Graveyard. HCW isn't going anywhere, still very much a part of Campfire Chronicles, but if you want to listen to that stuff, you can find it on our YouTube channel. We just did our WrestleMania event for HCW. Lots of twists and turns over the two-day event. Had a lot of fun doing it. Hopefully you enjoyed listening to it or watching it. And yeah, so without further ado now, let's get into the stuff with Clay Howard.
Don't steal my clip. All right, everybody. Early. You see what you did? Everybody, please help me welcome the awesome Clint Howard. I have not gotten to talk to you yet all weekend. Are you having a great time?
No.
Terrible? Wait. You guys up here in Sacramento and this area are really, really cool.
Thank you.
My wife, Kat, and I have, from the moment we got here, the people that are running this convention, people that are coming up to the table, people that just want to step up and say hi, you know, it's you're making us feel really, really welcome. And we heard that there's a film festival component to Sinister Creature Pond, and that they run film festivals. And I certainly, Kat and I are going to look real hard at certainly circling back and participating in the film festival. Now, this might be a year or so away, but you know, we are making another ice cream day. No, it's not a sequel. It's a standalone film that we're really excited about. Kat is one of the producers, and I'm one of the producers, and Norman Apstein, the original director, who we're very close with, he's one of the producers. Norman and I are slogging through writing the screenplay. It's not slogging through, although the process of writing a screenplay, you know, can be tedious and temperamental at times, but we have a draft that we really like, and we're literally looking forward to getting it on its feet and getting it made, and then delivering it to you guys. So, if things work out to be able to show it up here at in this community, because I'm not kidding, you guys got a great vibe, and we appreciate it.
So you said it's a standalone, so no relation to original at all?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever wondered what it takes to make it in the movie business? Peel back the curtain with 4-6 Success Filmmaking. 4-6 Success Filmmaking is where filmmakers share their stories and the secrets.
It's beyond competitive out there.
There have been movies that it's taken me 10 years to get made.
Don't wait to create. Like, you've got to just keep making stuff.
Tune in to 4-6 Success Filmmaking for your dose of cinematic realness direct from the voices that have lived it.
Now, No. It's simply a movie that Norman and I and Kat have concocted. It's a premise of a movie that is completely different, backstory, different characters. The only similarity is that I'm gonna play the ice cream man. Except I'm a 60-year-old ice cream. A 60-year-old ice cream man, and Norman and I's goal in the movie, in the screenplay, is to really set it up so you understand why a person puts body parts in the ice cream. At the beginning of the movie, our lead character is not going to put body parts in the ice cream, but by about page 40, it's going to be plain that he probably deserves to put body parts in the ice cream. And if these fucking kids want Rocky Road, they're going to get Rocky Road with real nuts.
The Ice Cream Man movie, which we have seen from the past, is such a cult classic. And you are, you had me, in tears the entire time. So I knew your one-liners the whole time. You guys had to have had a blast doing that. The body parts, the eyeball and the Sunday, all that kind of stuff. Looks like it was a blast to make.
Yeah, no, Norman was a good leader back in those days. It was 1995 or 1994, I think, is when we made it. Low-budget movies can be a challenge. All movies can be a challenge, I love working in film. I love working, any time when I get to express myself and be creative and do what I do, which is, act and deliver a character into a story that fits and makes sense. Listen, we were just making it at the time. We were making it, and, my secret tip to becoming the ice cream man was, and in the screenplay, the original screenplay, it said right away that Gregory had a growl of a voice. So, okay, how does Clint Howard, the actor, develop growling? Well, I screamed at the top of my lungs for the time it took me to get from my house to the set every day in my car. I mean, really scream. I was in a punk band, so I did a lot of screaming, in my early 20s. But when I had an opportunity to be in an ice cream band, I took the screaming onto the screen. And by the time I would get to the set, that was it. About all I could do is talk like that. So then I'd turn it into this growl. There will be similarities. There will be little Easter eggs in the movie that Norman and I are writing. And one of them probably is going to be that growl. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's a little easier to generate a growl if you're 60 years old. I certainly won't have to scream on my way to the set every day. In fact, I probably will be sipping hot tea with lemon and honey. I'll still be growling.
Well, your family. I listened to an interview with your brother when you guys were promoting the book you guys put together, and you guys touched on your parents' story of from being in Oklahoma to moving to New York, then to L.A. Ron is casted at an early age. You follow pretty much right behind. Show business seems like it's in your blood between the two of you, Bryce Dallas. This lineage that you guys have, what was it like coming up, growing up in a family that was just kind of destined for show business?
Well, boy, you say destined. I don't know. Yeah, probably so. First of all, it's not just Bryce. Bryce has a sister named Paige who is an actress. And she's a wonderful actress, and she just, things haven't quite fallen for her the way things, fall for some people. And Bryce, her ascension into the top level of the entertainment business is amazing. Yeah. And she's, it's very, very, she deserves it. And so it's now generational. But when there was nobody in the entertainment business that our grandparents were not in the entertainment business. It was my mom and dad who had the unmitigated gall, the audacity to think that they could jump in their old Plymouth and travel from Oklahoma to New York City and break into to Broadway back in the late 40s? Are you kidding? My dad was a hick. My mom used to call him the sophisticated hick. I mean, I love my dad dearly. I love my dad. I mean, we lost him a few years ago, which was really the reason why we wrote the book. And that book, right away, by the way, is called The Boys, A Memoir of Hollywood and Family. And it is, it's, you know, we're real proud of the book. Ron and I are proud. It was a New York Times bestseller for a month. And it's available in audiobook. And it was a wonderful opportunity for me to speak my words. I know Kat, we went into the recording studio together, and for a couple of days, it was very emotional for me. Because, you know, writing it is one thing. There's a little distance when you're writing something. But when you're actually speaking it, and talking about your parents who are no longer with us, and talking about your brother who you love dearly, and the experiences that I had in the business, and listen, guys, I was not stepped on, kicked, talked down to, challenged, no sexual thing or anything. I mean, I think a big part of why Ron and I were sort of protected, if it wasn't just completely by God, it was Dad and Mom with their fierce, fierce, down-to-earth goodness. You know, I said the audacity. I said the audacity and the unmitigated gall of my parents to think they could do it. But over the years, the world saw their character. The world saw my dad's character. And my dad, Rance Howard, was absolutely one in a zillion. You know, here he comes out of Oklahoma. No experience in the business. He was a farm boy. He had no business doing any of that. And yet, he had some sort of intestinal fortitude. And he had the perseverance to stay with it. And then, when a few things broke for him right, my dad was hired to be in the Broadway version of Mr. Roberts, the old play that Hank Fonda had done. And then they made a movie with Jack Lemmon. And it was, it ended up being, for a lot of people a little older, they remember Mr. Roberts. But my dad was in the Broadway play. And yet, when things started falling for him, he was not intimidated by anybody. My dad could sit with the biggest people in the entertainment business and not feel intimidated. And he didn't deliver intimidation himself. He didn't come back and be a bully. He wasn't one of these guys that people were afraid of. My dad was a guy that they respected. And he taught both Ron and I a work ethic that was just, I mean, by example and also by guidance. You know, nothing beats a good hard day's work and a worker who can really dig in when the times, you know, when the time comes to really dig in and work. Like I tell a lot of people, you know, virtually anybody could be an actor at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. When you're fresh and alert, and you're the least bit prepared, it's great. Try being an actor after about 14 hours of being on the set, after 7 or 8 bad cups of coffee, and a really really poor dinner meal. In show business, they call it second meal. They always feed you. They feed you after 6 hours, they have a lunch break. But then if they go over, they have to bring in a second meal, and it's usually just, no offense to El Pollo Loco, but it's just that kind of, Taco Bell, they'll go and get, bring in $200 worth of Taco Bell. And, you know, if you guys remember, you know, if these guys had the experience, eating Taco Bell that's more than about 10 minutes old is challenging. Try eating Taco Bell that's been in the back of somebody's station wagon for an hour. Oh, guys, this is your second meal. Well, in show business, the expectation is you got to be good. At 7 o'clock at night, when the wind's blowing and it's really cold or it's really hot, whatever the circumstances is, you're a professional, and by God, you got a freedom to focus up and do your job. Because I was always taught as a kid, I have a job to do. Come in prepared, understand what I'm doing, and then deliver. You know, and I learned it was wonderful. So again, I don't mean to run on and on.
No.
That's like one of the key things my dad taught me when I was little.
No, that's awesome to hear. Your guys' family, I mean, your filmography, you have over 200 credits. You've literally been in every kind of movie that I can conceive of, and the range of which you have done is so vast that it really touches every form of cinema. Like, you have voiced Rue from Disney, staying in the same voice acting. You've gone from that range all the way to Cthulhu in On the World of El Super Bisto with Rob Zombie. Your guys' body of work that you, and now, as you say, generational, your nieces are putting in is really just inspiring, for lack of a better term. So, I mean, congratulations, man.
There's a trick to that, and that is never say no. I've been in the business long enough, it's 61 years, one trick of getting a massive resume with all sorts of credits is just say yes to stuff. And, Dad taught me early on. In fact, it was really on Evil Speak. I was an adult when I did Evil Speak, but I was young. I was probably, maybe 20 years old or 21 years old. And when I had the opportunity to get hired to play Stanley Cooper Smith, a character who gets possessed by the devil and ends up cutting people's heads off, and the whole thing has a religious overtone, as I read the script, this is a wonderful opportunity to be in this movie. Did you see scene 75? I literally goes, Jesus, do I do this devil movie? And my dad said, son, if you don't do it, somebody else will. It is just a movie. This is all just play acting, And they want to hire you. They think you're going to be good at it. And just to let you know, if you don't do it, there will be another actor that plays that role. So, I said yes to stuff. I said yes to, from Ticks to kid movies, Gary Coleman projects and all sorts of things. When I was a kid, I always had a choice whether I could act or not. My mom and dad, when I would book a job, they would always say, Clint, they want to use you on the Red Skelton Show. Now, it's going to mean that you're going to be away from school for a few days or whatever the circumstances was. Would you like to do the job? And I always was given, the opportunity. But later on, when I became a teenager, sometimes the answer was, no, I don't want to miss school. I don't want to miss baseball games. I want to do what, that's why for a lot of people, you slow down as a teenage actor. Because there's other things that draw your attention. But, I would say yes. And I continued to say yes. And, as an adult, some of it was economic. Listen, I like gainful employment.
Right.
When they asked for my social security number with the concept of me being paid for acting, boy, I think that's just Jim Dandy. it's just a wide range of stuff, And then later on in my life, I certainly relish the idea of being in all sorts of funky stuff. Well, I'll tell you one job that I turned down, and this shows you my mentality in that moment. Remember the original Flintstones with John Goodman and Rick Moranis? Well, I got offered a role to play one of Fred and Barney's bowling buddies. And it was a couple of weeks' work, but it wasn't, there was a few lines. Mostly I was just kind of one of his bowling buddies. And I thought, well, this is wonderful. I knew the director. Well, this is great. The only thing that's not great is, the friggin' outfit I was going to have to wear? Did you see the movie? It's kind of fur skin kind of thing with, furry underwear. Didn't like that. And I just, at that time, I didn't see myself getting into one of those outfits. And you know what? After the fact, I kind of regret it, because now it would be a fun credit for me to be in that movie. And yet at that time, my vanity or whatever it was, I don't want to be one of them wearing the silly costume. Well, you know, I was a 35-year-old a-hole.
One franchise in particular that you have touched more than most, if not all, just because you have come in at just different points of the timeline, is Star Trek. It's pretty cool that to be able to say that you have gotten to be part of several different timelines, that it wasn't just like a reoccurring role on like Next Generation, that you got to, you know, have these different characters that you got to portray all the way back to the original. What was that like, or what has Star Trek meant to you throughout your career? Were you a fan before you got the, I mean, you came in with Kirk or anything, like, was it just another role at that point, and then as you return, it's blown up, obviously, like, what was it for you?
Well, yeah, at first, I was in the first season.
Yeah.
I knew very little about it, and just except as a kid, when, you know, when I auditioned, it was obvious it was a science fiction show, mm-hmm. and the character description was that he was a 600-year-old alien. And I was going to get to play it. That was kind of challenging, and that was fun. But you know, as far as the line, and I had a good time the day that I worked on the show. You know, I recall that William Shatner was very nice. Everybody was nice. The show went really good. The costume was uncomfortable because, you know, the costume was sort of like sequined silver something, and they didn't put a lining on the inside. And my little 6-year-old skin, I didn't like feeling the chafing of, you know, sequined costume on my body. Also, the shoes were a little tight, and then I had a headpiece that I wore, and they measured the headpiece for my regular head, but then I put on a skull cap. So the thing was friggin' tight. So anyway, I don't want to bitch about the work. But as far as it also is the whole Star Trek thing, I had no clue. For years, I've had no clue what Star Trek meant and what Star Trek meant to the public, you know. And for me, it was another job. Deep Space Nine was another job. It was fun to work on Enterprise because I worked with a couple people I know, Jeffrey Combs and Ethan Phillips, or Johnny, as he's known by. They played the Ferengis with me, and it was just, it was fun show business for a week while we were working on Enterprise. But I will tell you a little story about this, and it comes down to my perception of Star Trek. And that is, I auditioned for Star Wars.
Oh.
When I was 16, maybe 17 years old, I auditioned to play Luke Skywalker. This was way before videotape. So when they wanted to see actors and they were trying to find somebody, they were just beating the bushes to find somebody. They had a boatload of auditions and they were seeing a bunch of people. I mean, it wasn't quite like a public casting call, but the day I went in, there must have been 30 or 40 actors standing around. It was at 20th Century Fox. And I know we were waiting outdoors, and I saw Mark Hamill, and I only knew Mark Hamill from, he had auditioned, we were about the same age, you know, and we would run into each other once in a while at auditions, and you start to see the same faces, you know, so I noticed Mark Hamill, and, you know, I prepared, I looked at the sides, and I wasn't quite sure that I could handle this Luke Skywalker guy, but, you know, I auditioned. So I walked into the room, and I walked in, and Francis Coppola is right there. And he's larger than life, man. And he always has been. And my goodness, my jaw dropped. And then my brother had been in American Graffiti. So my brother knew George, and then George and his team knew me. So there was a guy named Gino Havens in the room, who was a confidant of George's, and there was a guy named Fred Roos. I didn't know it at the time, but he had been a casting associate on the Andy Griffith Show. And Fred Roos was a confidant of Coppola's and George Lucas. So I saw these people. and especially Francis, just made my heart stop. And I didn't see him for a moment because he was sitting in a big leather chair that swiveled. I didn't know, and he spun around in this leather chair, and it was George Lucas. And he looks at me, and he goes, "Commander Baylock, Corbomite maneuver." And in my mind, I went, "George, get a fucking life." Here was my perception. And the whole thing of him recognizing me from a job I did when I was a baby knocked me back. I was trying to get an adult role, and here he was making a reference to something I did when I was just a teeny weeny little baby. And it threw me off, you know, and I didn't get the job. And, you know, listen, as it turns out, Mark Hamill was a wonderful Luke Skywalker, and George is, you know, off to the races. But at that time in my life, I did not appreciate Star Trek. I didn't. In fact, I sort of rejected it in my mind. It was work I'd done when I was a kid, and I'm moving on to be an adult. And I would just as soon, back then, I would just as soon, you know, people not judge me as a child actor, and people judge me as an adult actor. And that perception I had of my juvenile work, especially being in Star Trek, carried on till I was probably about 40 years old. And when I began to understand the power that the Star Trek universe carries, the goodness of it, the quality of it, and, you know, the show's changed a lot. The original Star Trek, you know, they had a lot of fun episodes. And they would get serious at times, but it was a little, you know, kind of campy a little bit. Yeah. And then they started to get deeper, and they've gotten really deep lately. Discovery, they go off to some weird places creatively. And I don't believe I'm going to get myself in any real trouble because I know those producers. But, you know, they've made another series called Strange New Worlds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a really good chance, unless they cut me out, I'm going to be in my fifth Star Trek series.
Wow.
I think I can officially say this puts me in rarefied air. Yeah. And no one has gone from the original series through Discovery, through Strange New Worlds.
Yeah.
So there it is. Yeah. That was
awesome.
Where no man has gone before.
Yes, well, that's about me. Yeah, no man has gone before. Well, I've been there. I've been there, and the residual checks are pretty good.
Before we open it up to Q&A, the other thing that makes you another accolade is getting to actually finally get that little cameo in Star Wars. So you've been in both sides. Your brother directed Solo. Our channel very much celebrates Make Solo 2 Happen Day every May because it needs a sequel. Your brother did an awesome job as a director for that one. And yeah, immediately, as soon as you came up on screen, I'm like, that's Clint right there. So you got both in under your belt, which is awesome.
Yeah, it was fun. It was really fun to fly over. You know, Ron replaced a couple of guys that were directing Solo. So they were 70-some-odd days into the movie when they decided they needed to make a switch, which is a little baffling. Didn't they know after a couple of weeks that these guys were sucking gas? Yeah. They waited until 77 days into the production to fire the first director. So anyway, Ron got hired. And, Ron called. I'll do a little Star Wars story here. You know, George Lucas has always been a mentor to Ron. And Ron really loves George and really appreciates him and respects him. And immediately, once the deal was done that Ron was going to step in and direct this movie, he called George. And, he gave this, "George, I just want to let you know that I'm going to be taking over directing Solo." And the first thing that George says, "Well, I told him to hire you from the beginning." So that's how much I listen to George. It was fun to work on, and I was so proud. You know, Ron had really a week of pre-production before he had to start shooting with live bullets. And you know, I flew out there. I bet you he'd only been working for a couple of weeks when my scenes came up. And I was so proud of watching my older brother at the tip of this enormously elaborate, sophisticated spear. Because, folks, they make Star Wars like they make no other movie. The equipment they use and the skill and the craft, this is over in London, they shot it. It's just, I was blown away, and what made me even more proud is that they put my brother at the tip of the spear. You know? And so, it is a good movie. I haven't seen all the Star Wars movies. I've seen a few of them, but I was really impressed. I thought it was going to suck.
We have time for like one or two questions for Clint.
Sorry, I'm kind of long-winded, but I got my mom's gift of gab.
Does anybody guess?
Okay, so my mom loved you like when she was a child. I love you as an adult. My son loves you as a child. But I really, really, so she told me about the bear show, the Georgie show, is that right?
Gentle Ben.
Gentle Ben, that's it. I watched it for the first time and I'm thinking, how is this little kid playing with these little black bears? And did you really do that? And what was that like?
Yeah, well, the bears that we used were not carnivorous animals. They showed me right away that if you dropped a piece of meat into their cage, they would sniff it but not eat it. But if you dropped in a box of donuts, they would devour it like they were a diabetic. And I'm not a donut. I'm just a piece of meat. There was no fear. I mean, the size of them was a little bit cumbersome. And they were very slow. Bruno and Buck, the two main bears, just didn't move very fast. And when you're doing 10 or 12 pages a day of television, you need to be chop, hit your marks and let's go. And the bears, you know, they were just slow. So I was always pulling on this bear's chain, getting them to go somewhere. And, I enjoyed it. I appreciated it. We did two seasons of the show. And then when it was over, yeah, I missed it. I missed it. But onward and upward, and pretty soon I was having 12-year-old adventures.
Thank you.
Well, man, unfortunately, we're out of time.
One more. This guy's got a real quick one right here.
As the ice cream man, do you yourself like ice cream?
Oh, I love ice cream. And I'm not lactose intolerant.
What's your favorite flavor?
I love coffee ice cream. I love coffee ice cream, but in a pinch, chocolate, baby.
What's the one flavor that, even if it's the last ice cream that you're going to get for like 6 months, you're absolutely not having this flavor?
I'm not a big strawberry. I'm not a big berry guy. I don't really like to mix that into my, if there's cake with cherries or cake with strawberries in it, it literally, it's a chocolate cake. If I can find a pure bite of chocolate, I'll eat it. But if it's a mix, I'll just assume pass. But in a pinch, I eat the strawberries.
Well, one thing's for sure, I'm glad that you did not pass on all the roles that we got to talk about and so many more. Awesome resume, tons of memories for us to always go back and watch you do your thing on, man. So thank you very much for being with us. Everybody, thank you.
So there you go. Hope you enjoyed listening to some of Clint's stories and everything that he had to talk about in his illustrious career. And really is one illustrious career. Like, he has lived a hell of a life and he has had a hell of a run. And he is someone that, without question, will continue to do so. Next week on the podcast, we will have from a current movie that is out right now called Bag of Lies, director of Bag of Lies, David Andrew James. And so he will be our guest next week on the Horrific Podcast. Until then, stay spooky. Enjoy all the podcasts that will be coming out very soon, if not already, upon you listening to this week and next week. This week, I mean, yesterday's podcast, still one of my favorite Han episodes of all time, when Jason went to Fright Fest and the disappointment that he had. So stay tuned for all of that, and we will be back next week. And yeah, stay spooky, everybody.
May the stars light your way throughout all your journeys. May the stars light your way throughout all your days. May you see all the world, systems, stars, and planets. May the stars light your way and see you safely home. Did you